Well, to make the most out of the gardening season, June is the best time to plant tomatoes, eggplants, and other veggies. Hi, John Munson here, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us for another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. We appreciate all of our Garden Talk guests, but the breadth and depth of knowledge that our UW Extension guests have is absolutely amazing. Patty Nagai is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County. She has a wealth of information to share, and we're always happy when she can join us on Garden Talk. Patty, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you, John, and thanks for that amazing introduction. I admit you're making me have a lot to live up to now in this episode.
No pressure.
Well, I always enjoy being here. It's great. You have such amazing listeners with really great questions, and so it's always a lot of fun.
Well, the pressure's on me because I'm the one sitting in for Larry Mueller, so.
Yes, I expect a lot from you.
Oh. Well, you and my mother both. Okay, let me give the phone number before we get too far off the track here. 800-642-1234. That's the number to call with your gardening questions. 800-642-1234. You can also post to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page or send us an email, talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And let's start with an email. Question just off the bat here. We have a person who emailed in. I have a couple of areas that I'm growing tomatoes and peppers. In one area, there are a lot of small brown ants creating multiple homes everywhere. Just yesterday, I noticed in my raised bed planting area a lot of black and red ants. My questions, will the ants damage my vegetable plants, and can I use something to eliminate the ants that will be safe for my plants?
Well, that's an interesting question, but the ants, you know, the ants are very opportunistic as far as where they make their homes. If they're in a nice loose soil area that's easy for them to tunnel down in and get their queen settled and raising all those little baby ants, then, you know, they're going to do it. So you find ant hills all over the yard. It can be up into, you know, the shrub beds around your house. It can be in your vegetable gardens, your perennial beds, or it can be out in the middle of your lawn. There are, you know, many ways to kill the ants. There are some baits that you can use. There are methods where you can take a pipe of some sort, a PVC tube, or a large stick even to make a hole to go very deep in the ground, and then you can use an insecticide to kill those ants. But if they are in your vegetable garden, you've asked a really good question about what can I use that's going to be okay for my vegetables. And so the key to that is always reading the label. If it does not have vegetable crops on the label, then no, you cannot use it in your vegetable garden. But that being said, there are a number of insecticides that are perfectly okay to use in the vegetable garden if you so desire. But the ants are really not going to hurt anything. Ants, for the most part, don't bother plants. They are either sugar eaters or protein eaters. They are going after other things. They really like to settle in, like, for example, in near a tree that might have a mealybug or scale infestation, because they like to eat the excrement of those particular insects because it's very sweet and sugary. But a lot of times they have very different food sources. And so, you know, mostly they don't affect the plants too much. They can if they get in really large numbers, but it's not intentional. Can you live with the ants in your vegetable garden? Are they going to bite you? Are they bugging you? Are they keeping you from gardening? In that case, you might want to look at an insecticide that you can use in the vegetable area that you can get deep down in the hole. Because if you don't kill the queen, the ants will just continue to come back.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we'll have a lot more questions as we move along. But first of all, you know, we're coming to the end of the first week of June. And so it's time to get going on tomatoes, isn't it? I mean, I'm in Superior, you're in Madison. Can we both be planting tomatoes the same time of the year?
Probably not, but I'm not sure, John. Have you gone out and checked your soil temperature yet?
No, but I do notice that my wildflower seeds that I planted 2 weeks ago are coming up, and they need a soil temp of above 65 degrees. We've had enough sunshine, so even if the air is cold, I think the soil's fairly warm, but I have not checked my soil's temperature.
And that's an important thing to do when you're growing most of the warm season vegetable crops like tomatoes, peppers, and eggplant, because they really like not just warm air temperatures, but also warm soil. And a mistake that a lot of people make in Wisconsin, and this is true in the southeast Wisconsin as well as the northwestern portion of Wisconsin, that, you know, you want to get the tomatoes out early enough so that you can get fruit at a reasonable time. You don't want to be getting your first ripe tomato fruits at the end of September to be followed a week later by a frost. So people are very anxious to get these plants out early. But if you plant them too early and the soil temperatures are still cold, the roots can become very chilled, and it can actually stunt the plants so that they don't perform well throughout the rest of the year. So it's important to measure your soil temperature. And what I like to tell people down in the southeastern corner of the world is that, you know, we usually use Memorial Day as sort of a benchmark for when we can put the tomatoes out, but to measure the soil temperatures. And if you're getting up into above 55, 60 degrees, it's probably okay to transplant those plants into the garden, keeping in mind that if we do have an unexpected frost, that you have some method of covering the plants to protect the top part of the plant from a light frost.
So how deep do we need to put our thermometer to get an idea of what the soil temperature is?
Well, how deep are you planting your tomato plants? So,
well, see, you're talking to the wrong guy here, because I've never planted a tomato plant in my life, which is where the pressure of hosting this show comes from. So let's assume I know nothing about planting tomatoes. How deep should I plant them? And that's the depth that I would measure the soil temp at then.
Right. And so for tomatoes are really unique in that we can plant tomatoes very deep in the soil. If you are so inclined, you could, and you have a tomato transplant that's 18 inches tall, you could plant that plant 18 inches deep in the soil. You can also, if the stem is flexible enough, you can plant it in a trough and sort of bend the growing tip up so that just the top leaves are above the soil. And by doing that, you allow the tomato, the entire stem of the tomato, to develop roots. The bigger your root system, the overall better growth you're going to have of that plant and the more fruit it's going to produce in the long run. So when you talk about the depth that you measure the soil temperature, normally I measure the soil temperature at about a 4 to 8 inch depth. So most soil thermometers are about 4 to 6 inches long. If you've got a composting thermometer, it might be 2 feet long. You know, you've got some thermometers that, of course, are much longer than that. But we generally like to measure the soil temperature in that 4 to 6 to 8 inch range. The top inch of soil, that temperature is going to vary a lot throughout the day and from one day to the next. But by the time you get down a few inches, you know, you're looking at a pretty constant temperature. And it takes a long time for that soil mass to really warm up. So even in the southeast corner of Wisconsin, we often don't hit that 65 to 70 degree soil temperature at that depth until the middle of June. And in some seasons, it hasn't been until July. So I always, you know, caution people about planting their tomatoes too soon, but I don't want them to wait too long to plant them either. So somewhere when that temperature is between 55 and 60 degrees is a good ballpark measure.
So what should we be considering when trying to figure out where we're going to plant our tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, vegetables like that?
Well, they're warm season. So we already talked about we need to have warm soil and warm air temperatures. They also require full sun. And unlike some of the leafy vegetables, the plants that develop fruits that we want to harvest require full sun. And what that means is you have to have a location in your yard that gets at least 6 hours of direct sun every day. If you have more than that, that's great. But a lot of times, especially in urban environments, people are working around structures, houses, garages, fences. They're working around mature trees. They're trying to, you know, find a place that gets enough sun for these types of crops. Sometimes it's really difficult, especially if you have a small yard. So, you know, tomatoes grow really well in containers. And so you could actually put a container on your patio and plant that way. You could construct a raised bed, you know, just off your patio so that you have a closer place that is perhaps a little bit away from the house, a little bit away from the trees, and you can grow your tomatoes and peppers there. But they do require full sun.
Well, I'm actually considering a patio garden where I would plant some tomatoes in containers because I would like to have some tomatoes and peppers. But the yard I have now is, beds are for flowers. That's a domestic issue. And I'm the one that eats the tomatoes. So I'm actually thinking about getting some kind of a container and trying to plant tomatoes this year. I'll let you know how that turns out.
Well, I hope it goes well for you, but I would encourage you to negotiate a little bit and try to figure out if there are ways that you could incorporate a tomato, an eggplant, or a pepper plant into the ornamental garden, because those plants are actually very pretty. Eggplant and pepper plants especially are very beautiful, and they can be kind of merged into an ornamental garden very nicely. It's just, if you do that, you have to be careful about any kind of chemical controls that you might use during the year, you know, that you could use on an ornamental plant that maybe you wouldn't want to use on your edible plants. But there are lots of ways to incorporate vegetables into an annual bed or even a perennial flower bed.
Well, I will take note of that. Negotiations will continue. So if we want to promote deep rooting, so preparing the soil, how do we want to work that?
Well, like most vegetable crops and most plants in general, tomatoes like a very organic soil. They want it to be well drained. They need it to hold moisture. For most people, adding compost is going to be, you know, your best bet. So whether you're growing in a confined area like a raised bed, or you're growing in an established garden or a new garden that you've put out in the middle of your lawn, compost is one of the best things that you can do for your soil to amend it to really help the growth of a lot of different plants, not just tomatoes. Tomatoes are pretty resilient, though. You know, they come from a plant family that is pretty darn tough. There are lots of plants in that Solanaceae family that can survive extreme salt, drought, even, you know, really extreme temperatures. And so they've got some tough genetics behind them. But they do, you know, if you're going to pamper your plants and make them grow really well and produce a lot of fruit for you, you need to provide them with the soil condition that they will grow the best in, which is a nice organic-based soil that will hold some moisture but not be overly wet. That's the death of most vegetable plants is too much water. So if you've got a heavier soil that holds water, or you're trying to put a vegetable garden in a low part of your yard, that's going to create some problems for you, and raised beds might be the best way to go in order to establish a better root zone for those plants so that they can grow better. So, but compost, lots of compost.
Compost, I've got a note of that. Compost, got to have that. Okay, we're going to take a break here on Garden Talk, and when we come back, we'll talk about how to decide between the various types of tomatoes, which one would work best in your garden. And we'll take more of your questions. We have calls coming in. There are some Facebook posts we want to get to, including we have a message from someone who has an idea for our earlier emailer about her ant problem, and we'll get to all of that stuff as we continue with Garden Talk on the Ideas Net. Patty Nagai is my guest, a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County. Patty and I will be back in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today we're talking about tomatoes and eggplants and peppers and other plants that we'll be setting out soon as the soil warms up and we actually get summer. Tomatoes, and I didn't know this before I read up on this before coming into the studio today, tomatoes are the most popular homegrown vegetable in America. And we're talking about how to plant them and how to have good success today on Garden Talk with Patty Nagai, UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County. So before we go to questions, I just wanted to pose this one to you, Patty. How to decide what kind of tomato is the best one for our garden?
That's a huge question. A lot of it depends, you know, first of all, what kind of tomato do you like to eat? So are you looking for a grape or a cherry, or you want a big beefsteak tomato? Are you interested in making salsa? Are you wanting a paste tomato? And once you know, if you're just going to grow one tomato, I like to grow like 10 different kinds. But if you're just going to grow one, it's really important that you grow the one that the fruit is the type of fruit that you're looking for. But the second really important consideration is, how big is that plant going to get? So if you're talking about growing a tomato in a container, you need to make sure that it's a cultivar that will grow in a container and stay contained. So indeterminate types of tomatoes will continue to grow forever and could grow over the roof of your house. Probably not the best group of tomatoes to put into a deck-type planting.
Considering how windy it is in Superior, I don't think I want any tomatoes that get that big.
No. So you would probably look more at the determinate type of tomatoes that are going to be the bush types that don't get as tall, or specifically, and this is could be whether you're putting them in a container or a raised bed or anywhere, you might want to look at some of the smaller container kind of tomatoes, that the plants stay very short and stocky and don't get real big, but they make a lot of fruit. Most of those types make cherry tomatoes or grape tomatoes. So we're looking at like the Tumbling Tom series, or Lozano, which was an All-America selection, has a wonderful, very sweet little cherry tomato, and it makes almost a plant that looks like a cascading tree, very stocky. And then there are other kinds, like the super bush container tomato, and that's the name of it, that only gets about 2 feet tall and has a stem that's probably 2 inches in diameter. And so it's a very stocky plant. And that makes more of a salad kind of tomato, kind of a mid-sized tomato. So, you know, those are the things that you would want to consider. And being up in Superior, the other thing you need to look at is, how long before I'm going to get mature fruit? So your season is kind of short. So you might want to look at some of the smaller kinds of plants that are labeled subarctic or polar in their names.
There are days when subarctic is a little bit of a question. Okay, well, we have a lot of questions coming in here, and I want to get to them. First of all, Jill from Rhinelander called in to suggest for our earlier emailer who had questions about ants. Jill suggests diatomaceous earth instead of insecticides for the person with the ant problem, and that doesn't hurt plants either. Diatomaceous earth,
yes. Diatomaceous earth is an interesting product, and it's often recommended for things that crawl across the ground, like slugs. And slugs are pretty sensitive to it because they have very soft bodies. I know that there is a recommendation for diatomaceous earth for ants, but you know, it's not a chemical, it is a particle, and the way it works is by tearing up their bodies and causing slow, painful death, which, you know, sometimes people are into that sort of thing, especially if they've got slugs that are destroying their plants. But the problem with ants in using something like diatomaceous earth is that it's only going to kill those little worker ants that are on the top of the ground. It's not going to eliminate the hill, because that queen is still down there and she's still going to be, you know, making babies all summer long, and you're going to have a continuous supply of worker ants, you know, that are still going to come up to the top. And so although it might work on a temporary basis, I don't think it's going to be a long-term solution for getting rid of those ant hills. You know, according to our entomologist, the only way to really get rid of those anthills is to kill the queen.
Hmm. Here's a Facebook question from Tim, who writes, all of my tomatoes have droopy leaves. I don't think watering is an issue. Any idea what's going on?
Oh, that's sad. It could depend on where he is. Because it is a warm season plant, it is sensitive to cool temperatures, and sometimes you can get droopiness from not having warm enough temperatures. The other potential problem is that it might be planted too close to a black walnut tree. Black walnut trees are beautiful, and I don't recommend that anybody just go cut them all down, because actually that doesn't help the problem. But the bigger the tree, the more of a chemical called juglone they're going to excrete into the soil. And tomatoes happen to be very sensitive to juglone. So if you've got a mature walnut tree even 200 feet away, it could be affecting your tomatoes. And typically, it doesn't have an effect on the tomatoes until they get pretty good sized, because the roots of the tomato have to expand enough to get into the root system of the tree. And then that will be that area where all of that juglone is being excreted. And then the tomato plant will start taking up that juglone. And it will eventually kill the tomato plant. So, you know, monitor the temperatures, but also take a look around in your yard and your neighbor's yard and see if there's not a black walnut tree somewhere nearby.
All right, Tim, good luck with that tomato problem. Let's go to the phones where Pete is with us from Milwaukee. Pete, hello. Welcome to Garden Talk.
Hi. I have two questions. One, how do you prune a tomato plant so it doesn't spend time growing tall but just bearing tomatoes?
Well, that's kind of a tricky question because it depends on what kind of tomato plant you have. And if you are growing the determinate types or the bush type of tomato plants that only, you know, they're not going to get really tall. And they're going to make a lot of side branches. And you want them to make those side branches because that's where you're going to get the majority of your fruit from. So if you want a shorter tomato plant, you should buy determinate cultivars. So plants that are going to grow to 3, 4, 5 feet tall, and they're going to end in a flower bud. They're not going to get any taller. And you don't typically prune those kinds of tomatoes because you want all those side branches. When we talk about pruning tomatoes, it's usually the indeterminate types of tomatoes that we're talking about pruning, but it's pruning out those little suckers, those little side branches that come out from the nodes on the leaves, because you don't want it to make a lot of side branches. You want it to have a few side branches, but you actually want to encourage that height. If your plant is getting beyond the height of your trellis, pole, cage, however you're supporting it, you know, top-wise, and you're not getting a lot of fruit production, it has nothing to do with your pruning technique. It may have to do with the fact that your soil is too rich in nitrogen. And so for most of our vegetable crops, it's a good idea to at least once every 5 years or so get a soil test and see how your soil is. In some parts of the state, we have really rich soil with lots of phosphorus and potassium. And the only thing we need to add is a little bit of nitrogen, but a little bit of nitrogen at the beginning of the season when the plants are first established, and then really nothing the rest of the year. Because if you have too much nitrogen, you're going to get a lot of vegetative growth and very little fruit production.
Okay, Pete, what was your second question?
Okay, the second question I have, I went to a garden center where they were selling telescopic water wands, mm-hmm. and they all had warnings on it. And the warning said this product contains chemicals known in the state of California to cause cancer, birth defects, and other reproductive harm. Wash hands after handling. And I'm just very concerned about it. Most of them were made in China, but I did buy one from Taiwan. I'm alarmed about that. Can you answer that?
Well, that is very odd. The only thing I can think of is that they must have some sort of, I don't know if it's a BPA plastic, maybe? Are they, they're not metal?
Yeah, it's metal. I mean, I'm holding it right now. It looks okay, but it just says wash hands after handling and that warning that I told you about.
Well, that's very strange. I haven't seen that. I'm going to go look right after the show. I'm going to go look for one and see if I can find it. I don't think I would have purchased that one. There are lots of really good quality watering wands that are made here in the United States, and I have many of them. I have not seen that warning, but that's very interesting. I will certainly look for that. But no, I don't know what it is. You could probably go online to the company, the manufacturer's website, and see what exactly those chemicals are. And that's just really strange.
Hmm. They try a different store. Look for a different one. Let's see. Pete, thanks for your call. Let's go next to Mike, who is joining us from Green Bay today. Mike, welcome to Garden Talk.
Hey, thanks. I've got planting my first garden this year. I purchased 3 plants from a local nursery here in town. They're about real healthy looking. I picked the 3 strongest looking ones. 2 of them were Amish paste.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what the other one was. More of a slicing tomato.
Okay.
Real healthy. I planted them last Saturday or Sunday. Right now, they're all wilted, folded over, and the leaves aren't dusty, but they're white and wilted.
Oh.
I've kept up on my water. I'm not drowning them.
Okay.
But I probably watered them about 3 or 4 times since Sunday.
Were these plants, did you buy them from a greenhouse? Were they inside a greenhouse?
Yes, they were.
Well, I think what has happened to your poor little plants is that they did not get properly acclimated to the outside. So you did this yourself to these poor little guys. So tomato plants, you know, when they're growing in a greenhouse, they are growing and they're warm and they're happy and they don't quite have full sun, because even in a plastic hoop house, you know, there's some reduction in the quantity and quality of the light rays that are coming through. And so they're sort of in a protected environment and they don't get wind. And so they're getting lower light and they're not subjected to wind, and they are very constant temperature, and they're just happy as can be and growing nice and sturdily. And then you bring them home and you put them in the soil, which probably is a little bit cooler than what they were appreciating in the greenhouse. And then it gets cooler at night. So you've got those differences in air temperatures, it takes a little while for plants to get used to those alternating night-day temperatures. But the worst offenders are the direct sun and the wind. And so because you're describing the foliage as being kind of wilty and whitish looking, that is a great example of sun scorch. So the wind exacerbates it, because the sun is beating down on these leaves that just don't know how to survive in that kind of light. And then the wind is passing over them and desiccating them. And so you're getting a double whammy hit to your poor little plants. It doesn't mean that they're doomed. They will adapt and acclimate. But had you time to do this over again, what you should have done is taken the plants and put them into kind of a sheltered location for the first day, maybe even bring them inside at night, and the next day take them out and have them be out a little bit longer, and then bring them back in and give them 4 or 5 days to actually get used to being outside, because it takes a while for those plants to make those physiological and structural changes that they need to make in order to survive that full sun and the wind that they're going to be exposed to. Look for new growth, and hopefully what you'll find is when those new leaves come out on top, they are developing in the outdoor environment and they will be fine. So you should be seeing a flush of new growth that looks really great, especially when we get into some warmer days and warmer night temperatures as well. So they're probably not dead, although I have seen people kill them completely doing this. But watch for that new growth and see if you've got some healthier leaves coming out. And then next time, you know, all new gardeners do this, and sometimes experienced gardeners do it. We just forget that our plants need a little bit of help those first few days.
Mike, good luck with those plants. I hope they come back. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Plenty of room for you on the phone right now if you'd like to call in with your question for Patty Nagai, UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County. We're talking about putting out your vegetable plants, tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, and that kind of thing this time of the year, how to do it, and so forth. But all of your gardening questions are welcome. Here's a caller, Brett from Green Bay, who couldn't stay on the line but wanted to ask a question about cherry tomatoes. Brett's in Green Bay. He wants to know where he can get cherry tomatoes to plant in his garden around Green Bay.
Wow, I am not familiar with all of the nurseries and garden centers around Green Bay, but I would assume that most places would have at least one type of cherry tomato. Sometimes the cherry tomatoes do get overlooked in garden centers, though, and they might not order in as many of those plants as they do some of the other beefier kind of tomatoes, or the plum type tomatoes, you know, the Romas and the beefsteaks and that sort of thing. But there are so many wonderful cultivars of cherry tomatoes that I would be surprised that he couldn't find any at one of the local garden centers.
Any reputable garden center would be likely
should have them.
Have
and
that.
You know, you want to look. You know, you just want to look at the tags really carefully to make sure that that's what you're getting. A lot of the cherry tomatoes, though, are indeterminate plants. So, like the Sweet 100s, and there's a new one out this year called the Bumblebee series of cherry tomatoes. The yellow pear is actually a type of a little pear-shaped cherry tomato. It's a smaller tomato. Those are indeterminate tomatoes vines, and so they're going to get really big. If you're looking for the specialty ones that are more of the container types, those may be very difficult to find. And we always start ours from seed so that we can get the cultivars that we want, like the Lozanos and the Tumbling Toms. But other than that, I can't tell you specifically, you know, who might have those, but maybe somebody else in Green Bay knows where they're selling cherry tomatoes.
Well, maybe somebody in Green Bay knows the answer to that question and will call 800-642-1234 and share that information with us or post it to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Here's a question from Peter in Ironwood. Peter, welcome to Garden Talk. Peter, hello.
Good morning.
Hi, Peter. What's your question?
Last fall, my rhubarb plant went to seed.
Okay. So did you want it to go to seed?
It was fine.
Okay.
And what I let all the seeds dry on the vine,
mm-hmm.
or on the stalk,
mm-hmm.
and then I picked them.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know how to store the seeds, the planting depth for the seeds, and how long it would take for the stalks to become viable.
Wow, I don't know the answer to that because I have never grown rhubarb from seed. Most of the time when people are growing rhubarb, they will cut those flowers off prior to any even hint of seed production because the flower and seed production really takes a lot of energy away from the plant. And most of the time people are going to reproduce rhubarb vegetatively as opposed to by seed. And depending on what, do you know what cultivar of rhubarb you're growing?
I have no idea.
Is it a really old plant? Is it one
yes,
that you've
it is.
Had for a long time? Well, it might be okay then. A lot of the newer cultivars of rhubarb are hybrids. And so the seed produced may not produce the kind of plant that you would be interested in for rhubarb stalks. But since I've never grown it before, I have no idea what the dormancy of those seeds are and whether or not there is a dormancy breakage requirement. You could try a couple of different things. You know, there are the basic seed planting method for a lot of plants is just to let them drop, you know, right where they are. And typically Mother Nature will take care of it itself. So rhubarb may be one of those plants that needs a cold treatment prior to germinating. So you could take some of your seeds and put them in some moist sand or a moist soil mix and put them in a container in your refrigerator for a couple of weeks and then bring them back out and try planting them. You could take others and plant them just directly into a pot right now, put it outside and see whether or not they grow. If they're really hard seeds that feel like BBs, like they have a really hard seed coat, you could take sandpaper and rough up that edge, or you could soak the seeds for a few hours in warm water before planting. So there are lots of things that you could try. But I bet if you just Googled it, somebody's already done all of that for you and they could tell you what the best way is to grow those seeds out. But it sounds like you're the kind of guy who likes to try different things. So maybe you want to do your own testing.
Peter, thanks for that rhubarb question. I actually planted some pie plant this year. I had two stalks I put in the ground, and mm-hmm. it looks like one of them actually may live. So there is hope for some rhubarb pie next year.
Yeah.
Let's see. We're going to take a quick break on Garden Talk. When we come back, we have more questions, including someone from Rice Lake who has a question about soil temperature for peppers. That we'll get to that when we come back, and your calls and questions as well. Post to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page or go to your phone and call us at 800-642-1234. Patty Nagai is my guest on this week's edition of Garden Talk. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator in Racine County. I'm John Munson in for Larry Mueller. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Larry Mueller. Larry will be back next week. My guest today on Garden Talk, Patty Nagai, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Racine County. Let's go back to the phones and take a question from Greg in Rice Lake. Greg, welcome to Garden Talk.
Well, thank you. John and Patty, you were talking earlier about the soil temperature in relation to peppers and tomatoes. And I've been dying to ask this question of all my green peppers. Every year when I plant them or transplant them, and I hard them off and all those things first, but when I put them in the soil, after maybe a week or so, I'll start to notice where the lower leaves start to drop off, and the plant will start to look more anemic, losing some of its green, rich color. And eventually those bottom leaves will just keep dropping off as you go up the line till all I have left is maybe one leaf in the center and a stem. And at first I thought it was an insect or a slug or something that might be snipping these leaves off. But I've rabbit-proofed my garden, and I think I've done everything as far as that possibility, even including putting a trail camera in on my garden to see if I see any wildlife going in and out, and I'm getting nothing of the sort. Mm-hmm. That said, if these pepper plants are planted in soil temperature too cool, and when I get home, I'm going to check to see if my soil temperature is at 65. But if I'm planting them too cool of a temperature, will pepper plants have that symptom where they just start dropping the leaves off from bottom to top?
They could. That could very well be what it is. There are a couple possibilities. You know, peppers, just like tomatoes, are very sensitive to cold soil temperatures. And, you know, the warmer the soil is, the better. If you're gardening in raised beds or containers, the soil tends to warm up a little bit faster than it does in an in-ground bed. So, you know, you need to measure the temperature in multiple locations to see how it's progressing throughout the spring before you decide to plant those warm season plants. So yeah, it could be that. And you said you were acclimating them correctly. Sometimes that is a problem. If they're not hardened off before they go into the ground, they will drop their leaves from that. It is a stress response. If it were a rabbit or a deer or something like that, you wouldn't have any plant left at all. They're not that neat as to just take it one leaf at a time. They go from the top and they'll just eat the whole thing, or, you know, a groundhog will pull the whole plant out of the soil. So I wouldn't guess that it would be any kind of critter. There are some insects that could potentially do that, but I think you're probably right that it probably is the soil temperature or some other environmental stress. That's a pretty common response for a lot of things. You know, there are trees like ash trees that in the spring, you know, they'll get these weirdo temperature changes and a little bit of wind, and then all of a sudden they drop all their brand new leaves. And people are always calling in and they're all worried about it, but trees will renew those leaves very quickly. Pepper plants, not so much. I mean, once you drop all of those lower leaves, you're setting yourself up for a bit of a problem and with reduced flower and fruit production. And even if you were to get fruit production, you need that foliage in order to protect the fruit from the sun. You know, if you don't have enough foliage on the plant, you don't have enough photosynthate actually to support the developing fruit, but you also need that foliage to physically cover the fruit to keep it away from the direct sun. So, measure your soil temperatures and see. Try planting some newer peppers, you know, once the soil temperature gets a little bit warmer, and see if you can't alleviate that particular symptom. It's always a good idea to know what your nutritional status is in your soil, but if you're adding compost on a regular basis and, you know, you've had your soil tested in the last 4 or 5 years, you're probably okay on that route. I wouldn't expect it to be a nutritional problem, but sometimes nutritional deficiencies or excesses can cause that kind of problem as well. But
Greg,
that's a little more uncommon.
Good luck with your peppers. Let's go to Gloria in Milwaukee next. Hi, Gloria. You're on Garden Talk.
Hi, I have two questions, actually. I planted tomatoes last year, and they just took off like gangbusters. It was wonderful. I only have one space to plant them, so my question is, if I plant the tomatoes in the same spot, which I know you're not supposed to do, is there anything I can add to the soil to rectify that?
Well, you know, if you're getting good growth on your plants, chances are your nutritional status is okay. Adding compost to the soil every year and just get into the routine of doing that is very helpful for a number of different reasons, because it can provide better drainage, and then of course the plant appreciates the organic matter that's added. But there's also some nutritional benefits to adding compost to the soil as well. And so if you're getting good growth, you may not need to add any additional fertilizer. If you're noticing that your tomatoes are yellowing or not growing very vigorously, especially yellowing on the lower leaves and moving up the stem, it could be an indication that you have a nitrogen deficiency. But I always caution people about not over-fertilizing your tomatoes, because it's very easy to get into a too much of a good thing with tomatoes, and you get an abundance of vegetative growth, and you really mess up your flower and fruit production. So if you do choose to use a fertilizer, make sure that it's a fertilizer that is rated for tomatoes or flowering and fruiting plants, and follow the label directions. Don't put more on than is recommended on the label. The other thing that you would want to consider doing is mulching around those tomato plants, either using a biodegradable paper mulch or a really thick layer of fresh compost, good quality compost. You could use, if you've got clean grass clippings or straw, you can use a lot of different things for mulches. And then there are also those plastic mulches that you can use around tomato plants that actually work really well. Mulches will help keep the moisture in, so it keeps the soil temperature and moisture content kind of moderated over the season. But the other thing that it does is it keeps the soil from splashing up on the lower leaves of the plant and spreading disease. So that's the one thing we worry about. Well, there are a couple things we worry about with planting the same thing over and over again in the same spot. But disease is huge. You know, there's nutritional differences that you can kind of make up with fertilizers, but you're probably at some point going to get a buildup of certain disease spores in your soil, like for early blight or septoria leaf spot. And those types of things are what you want to protect your plants from.
Gloria, what was your second question?
My second question is, we have a lot of garlic mustard that isn't too far from where I would plant the tomatoes. So I'm wondering if that weed is treated, and I'm not sure, you know, how it would be treated, say if it were chemically sprayed, if that gets into the soil, mm-hmm. and it's, say, within 10 feet of the tomato plants, is that going to be a problem, you know, for the tomato plants as far as, you know, should we worry about eating?
Right,
right. It is always a good idea when you're growing edible crops to be very aware of any type of chemical application anywhere nearby. So your question has a lot of potential problems to it, because depending on what is being sprayed and how it's being sprayed and what day it's being sprayed on and whether or not the wind is blowing and specifically what chemical is being used, you know, that, yes, it could definitely affect your tomatoes. Or it might not. It just, there are so many factors that can affect that. However, especially this time of year, the best way to get rid of garlic mustard is to pull it. You know, once it sets seed, once it flowers and starts to make those seed pods, you could spray it and those seeds would continue to develop. And all you're doing is, you know, you're killing a plant that's going to die anyway, and it's still going to drop its seeds. So, you know, the best thing to do is either to pull or go and cut and remove those plants so that the seed does not drop in that location. Once the garlic mustard plant flowers and seeds, the plant itself will die, but each plant's going to make hundreds and hundreds of seeds that are going to drop in that same location. So where you had one plant last year, you're going to have 300 little seedlings coming up. So chemical control at this stage of the plant's life cycle is not really the best option for that particular plant.
Gloria, good luck with all of that. We had an email from Hans in Manitowoc regarding the telescopic wand question that we had earlier. Hans writes, the warning the caller was referring to relates to California's Prop 65 required warning. This refers to a range of many potentially harmful chemical or other exposures to consumers. Many garden tools have brass components. All brass is made with a very small amount of lead, generally less than 2 to 4%. Because of this minute lead content, products containing brass need to have this warning. Well, most hose fixtures have some brass on them, so that's probably where that comes from.
Well, I guess it would be on everything then, because all of the watering ones have brass connectors.
Yep.
The good ones, anyway.
So if apparently if you're not in California, you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about that lead. The other thing I was wondering, though, is a lot of them have, they have some plastics on them, too. And I was wondering if it might have had to do with the BPA content of the plastic.
Oh, that could be. Yeah, I don't know. But thanks, Hans, for clarifying that. That's good intel. All right. Let's go another question from Milwaukee. This time, Johnny is on the phone with us. And welcome to Garden Talk.
Hi. Nice to talk to you guys. You guys do a wonderful job.
Well, thank you.
We planted poppies last year, three mm-hmm. types of poppy seeds. Mm-hmm. Put them in the ground. Mm-hmm. They're coming up now. Mm-hmm. We have our first two gold or reddest poppies today. But along with those three types, some kind of bamboo-like plant came all through the whole garden there, and they're up to 7 to 8 feet tall. Ooh. And they were from those seeds. We don't know what those are, and if they're poppies or if they're not, should we cut them down, or what should we do about them?
Well, poppy plants don't look anything at all like bamboo. So, you know, poppies are very herbaceous, even when they're going into their flowering stage, and their leaves are sort of elongated with maybe a little, some of them have little fuzziness on their leaves, or a little kind of toothed edges on their leaves, and they don't get that tall. So I don't know of any poppy that gets more than 3 feet tall, even in flower. It's always possible that there are poppies that I don't know about that get that tall, but I can't imagine any that looks like bamboo.
We cut one apart, and it's hollow. One of these things is like a hollow tube.
Well, I was afraid you were going to tell me that. It sounds like what you have is Japanese knotweed. And that's a horrible thing to have in your garden. And I would recommend that you get out there and dig and pull and do whatever you can to get it out before it starts spreading, because it sends out very deep and tough rhizomes and is very difficult to get rid of once it gets established in a garden area. And it could be that you're going to have to sacrifice some of your little poppy seedlings in order to do that. Poppy seedlings don't like to be moved, but I have found that if you kind of shovel them up into a big scoop of soil, you can often transplant them successfully, as long as you're not trying to transplant like individual little seedlings. They really don't like to be moved very much, but my concern is if this truly is Japanese knotweed, you do not want any of that anywhere in your yard, and you need to do everything possible to get rid of it immediately.
Okay.
It will be a nightmare.
Okay, Johnny, I'm sorry about the nightmare part. Good luck.
Yes.
Good luck with getting rid of that stuff and getting your poppies healthy. Let's take a really quick question from Harry in Mukwonago. Harry, welcome to Garden Talk. What's your question?
I have 3-year-old strawberries in a raised bed, and they just don't seem to be as vigorous as they used to be, even last year. They're blooming and they're starting to fruit, but the foliage is just not there.
Hmm. Well,
anything I can do to...
Well, there's probably nothing you can do with those particular plants right now in order to make them better, because they're already in fruit production. Strawberries do require some maintenance and care, and you know, one of the most important things that a lot of people don't realize, depending on what kind of strawberry you plant, you may need to replant every year or every 2 or 3 years in order to keep production growing strong. So there are some types of strawberries that you let the runners develop into new little plants, and then there are other kinds that you're really supposed to clip those runners off in order to keep that mother plant growing and producing well. We have a really excellent publication on growing strawberries in Wisconsin at the Learning Store. And you might want to look that up and then look at the different types of strawberries and the different cultivars and when they mature, and consider replanting your strawberry bed, maybe with one, two, or even three different cultivars of strawberries to try and keep that production going strong for the next few years.
Harry, good luck. Good luck with those strawberries. Of course, this is the time when we start to really look forward to having that delicious red fruit and maybe some rhubarb to go with it.
Yes, strawberry rhubarb pie.
I am making myself hungry.
Mm.
Doesn't take much. All right, Garden Talk on the Ideas Network, heard every week at this time. Larry Mueller will be back next week, and he'll be talking with Lisa Johnson, a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Dane County, and she'll be along to answer your gardening questions, of course, along with Larry. And for those of us who tune in to hear Larry every week at every weekday at 11 o'clock, here's what's coming up on Monday. Larry will be joined by author Michael Perry, who will be discussing his book, Jesus Cow. And then at 11:45 on Monday, we'll hear from Vivian Probst, author of the book, Death by Roses. Well, that sounds kind of gardeny. We're happy that Patty Nagai was able to join us on this edition of Garden Talk. Patty is a UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County and a frequent guest on the Garden Talk program. A reminder that you can find this program and others just like it anytime you would like to listen to them on our website. Go to WPR.org and look for Garden Talk, and you can hear past editions of the program as well as today's program if you so choose. Cheyenne Lenz produced this hour of programming on the Ideas Network and handled on-air production. Thanks to Dave Potratz for his help as well. I'm John Munson, in for Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of WPR. Have you ever heard of Hansel and Gretel eggplants or Rapunzel cherry tomatoes? Well, today we're going to talk about growing your own fairy tale garden. Hi, I'm John Munson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Good to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk. Well, we've been learning a lot today, and we'll continue to learn, and I'm really fascinated by the idea of a fairy tale garden. And we have Patty Nagai with us, UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County, who can tell us all about that and answer your questions about gardening at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Comment or ask a question on Facebook, on the Look for the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Leave your comment there, or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. So, Patty, tell us about a fairy tale garden. You're growing one in Racine. What's up with that?
Well, All America Selections a few years ago started looking at vegetable plants that were attractive, compact, produced a lot of fruit that was really pretty. And they started looking at these eggplants that a company had developed. And the first one to come out was called Fairy Tale. And it's a beautiful plant. It has large, pale green, furry kind of leaves. And the fruit is lavender with white striping on it. And it makes kind of a bunch of fruit. It's really pretty. And so it met all of the requirements to be an All-America selection. And then about 2 years later, they selected another one from this same company called Hansel, which was a beautiful a dark purple, also a bunching kind of a more of an Asian style of an eggplant. So it has lots of fruit in a cluster, and they tend to be thinner and longer than the traditional Black Beauty kind of eggplant. And then the third in the series was Gretel. And Gretel is a white eggplant. And so when you plant them all together, you have a one that's producing this beautiful dark purple fruit, one that's producing this pure white fruit, and then a third that's producing this lavender fruit with the white stripes. And then for the first time this year, I found a tomato called Rapunzel. And Rapunzel tomato plant makes a cluster of cherry tomatoes that is enormous. And so that's why it's called Rapunzel, because the cluster, it's almost like a wine cluster, and it's very, very long, you know, 12, 14, 16 inches long, and it's has beautiful fruit developing all up and down this cluster. So this year we have our fairy tale garden with Hansel, Gretel, Fairy Tale, and Rapunzel all planted together in a tall raised bed so that the fruit can hang over the edge of the raised bed.
Well, that just sounds fascinating.
There are so many fun things that you can do with gardens, and growing edibles is, you know, it should be fun in addition to being healthy and nutritious and all of that. And there are so many wonderful kinds of plants that you can grow that have really funny names and really interesting growth habits. And I don't hesitate to plant things like that in my flower beds or in my herb bed, or put them in a separate container and use them as an ornamental piece on my deck, because they're beautiful plants. They just happen to be producing a delicious edible crop as well.
All right, let's see. We've got some emails, some Facebook posts here. We have a caller who couldn't stay with us, but wondered whether, Patty, if you know where he can get chocolate cherry tomatoes. Is there a website you're aware of, or some phone number that he can call? Chocolate cherry tomatoes. Now, that's a new one on me.
I know, and it makes you think that they're going to be like cherries covered with chocolate. But in actuality, the chocolate cherry tomato is another name for what used to be called brown cherry tomato, which doesn't sound nearly as good, does it?
Well, no, chocolate is much better marketing than brown. I mean, so, you know, brown is just, well, it's brown.
I know,
brown.
It's just brown. So
yeah.
Brown cherry tomatoes have been around for a long time, and chocolate is the new spin on the brown cherry.
So they've been
tomato.
Rebranded.
They've been rebranded,
yeah,
and that
okay.
happens a lot.
Yeah, the marketing department got loose in the garden. Oh,
well,
God help us now.
This happens with cultivar selection all the time, and it could be that the chocolate cherry tomato is actually a new selection of the chocolate cherry tomato. It might have been improved through breeding, or it might have been just a random event where there it had some great characteristics, or it could just be that it's a chocolate cherry or a brown cherry tomato that they simply have renamed. Either way, they're very good. They look funny because the tomato, I mean, it's a beautiful little spherical cherry tomato. It's not a grape tomato or a little pear or plum-shaped cherry tomato. It's a true round cherry tomato. It's about 3/4 of an inch to an inch across. It is brown. It's sort of brown and red together. And it is incredibly delicious. We grew them last year at my office building, actually, up a trellis. And it was, you know, the senior center is right next to my office. And the seniors would walk by and grab a handful and eat them on their way to the senior center because they're so good.
Our caller wants to know where to get them.
Well, I have seen them actually at a number of different places. So I think they are being wholesaled to even some of the big box stores. So you might want to check one of your big box retailers that has a temporary garden center set up. You might check there. But be aware that they do have two different names. So it may say chocolate cherry, it may say brown cherry. But I know other people who have found them down in Racine County at some local retailers. So they should be out there. If we were earlier in the season, there are lots of places that you can buy seeds for these and start yourself. But it's a little late to be starting seeds for tomato plants, so you need to find the plants.
Okay, good luck with those chocolate cherry tomatoes. Let's take a call from Bill in Dubuque next. Bill, welcome to Garden Talk.
Thank you. My question is about the onion family. I know the world is divided into two kinds of onions, long day and short day. I think that has to do with the number of hours of sunlight. But what my question is, shallots, which are just like onions, when's the best time to plant them, like in March or October?
Well, shallots, I've never grown shallots, and I don't think they have to be planted in the same fashion as garlic. You know, garlic is also in the onion family, and we plant garlic in the fall because it develops a fairly large bulb, and so much like other bulbing kinds of plants, tulips and daffodils and such, The garlic in the fall, when the soil is really warm, will develop a very, very extensive root system. In some cases, it can be 3, 4, 5 feet deep in the soil because the soil is still warm. And then the plant, you know, is ready for spring. And so then in the spring, the top part of the plant will emerge and the bulb will develop. And so it's a very long season plant. It takes about 9 months to grow a bulb of garlic. Shallots are a little different from garlic and they don't get quite that large. And I would think that you would be able to plant those in the spring, but you would plant them from sets the same way that you would plant, you know, onions. You of course can grow onions and all of these alliums you can grow from seed, but it just takes a lot longer to do that. And shallots, you know, they're not as commonly grown in the home garden. And I'm not sure why. So I would like you to grow them and then tell me how it works for you.
Bill, good luck with your shallots. There's a lot of different kinds of onions out there. I mean, you have scallions and shallots.
And hundreds of different types.
Is there a variety of sweet onion that we can grow in at this latitude?
There are. There are a couple of different ones that you can grow here. There's one called Walla Walla, and there's another one, I think, called Utah something. But the sweet onions are really dependent a lot on the growing conditions. So, for example, the Vidalia onion that is so popular and so incredibly sweet is trademarked, patented, can only be grown in Vidalia County in Georgia. You cannot grow and sell an onion anywhere in the United States that says it's Vidalia unless it actually is from Vidalia County.
Interesting.
So that is a trademark patent. I mean, it is highly regulated. But part of the reason that onion is so incredibly sweet has to do with their soil conditions and the warm air early in the spring. And so sweet onions tend to be very short season. So they grow best when it's just starting to get warm. They don't store well. They're not a storing onion. They will rot very quickly.
Because of all the sugar.
Yeah, they're just not the same as a pungent white or even a red onion. And when you look at different types of onions that are available for us to grow here, it's good to read those descriptions really carefully and look at the short day, long day is important too, because there are a lot of cultivars of onion that you should be growing starting in the spring, and then others that you should grow later in the fall and harvest them the next year. And it really depends on the cultivar and the type of onion it is. And there are a lot of them to select from. But we can grow onions very well here, as long as you're selecting the right kind.
Let's see. We have an email from Kelly, and Kelly wants to know, what is your favorite method of preventing cutworms from taking out tomato and pepper plants?
I like the exclusion method. So, you can buy collars for plants, but you can also create them out of various types of plastic or waxed paper or even aluminum foil to try and keep them from getting to your plants. There are, of course, insecticides that you can use as barriers to keep them from getting close to your plants. But I like the exclusion methods the best.
All right, exclusion. That's the best. All right, here's a Facebook question from Randy. Randy asks, how does your guest feel about using fish remains for fertilizer in a vegetable garden?
Well, it's very smelly. Fish, of course, is a traditional fertilizer of the Native Americans. It would, you know, fish is used a lot in organic gardening, but typically it is either composted or processed in some way. So you can buy lots of different organic fertilizers that contain some sort of fish emulsion. Whole fish, there are some problems with that. And I don't know about the food safety aspect of it. So with a lot of animal byproducts, you know, our food safety specialist will tell you that everything should be fully composted before you use it in your plants, use it with your plants. So any kind of manure especially needs to be fully composted for at least a year. But fish is, you know, the fish is a little bit different. But what I would be more concerned about is the animals that it would attract. And, you know, that odor is pretty pervasive, and I worry about that even using the fish emulsions. So the odor is reduced somewhat in those products, but it is still there. So you may end up, if you're using whole fish remains, you know, heads, intestines, whatever, the tails, all of that, you may end up with some unwanted visitors into your garden digging that up and destroying the plants that you just planted.
Use fish remains at your own risk.
Yeah, you know, as far as putting them into a compost pile, I think that's a great idea, you know, okay. Incorporating them into a compost pile. You may end up attracting visitors to your compost pile with that as well. So there are always going to be concerns when you're disposing of any kind of animal fish remains in an area where you're going to attract possum or raccoon or skunks.
Okay. All right. Randy, good luck with that. And here's a question from Marilyn on Facebook. Marilyn writes, my Northern Lights azalea flowered last fall. This year, it's not going to flower, but it is starting to put out leaves. Is there hope for it? Could I move it? And if so, when?
Oh, well, those Northern Lights azaleas are really pretty. I have killed several of them. I have to admit that. I think all good horticulturists kill plants at some point or another, and that's how we learn from our mistakes. It just so happens that in my yard, my pH is incredibly high, and trying to keep the pH in a range that those azaleas really like is very difficult if you have high pH, because they like acidic soils. I'm not sure why it bloomed in the fall, but if the leaf growth is good and it's dark green and you're getting bud production, I would not worry about it. You can't force it to flower. And it would have flowered. If it were going to flower in the spring, it would have flowered already. But right now, what you need to do is support that leaf growth and make sure that plant is really healthy in order to make flower buds that hopefully will stay put until next spring when it's supposed to flower. So it's gotten a little bit off kilter, and it probably has to do with soil and air temperatures messing around with those flower buds. But the flower buds are produced the year before, and so now that it's putting out its new flush of leaves, the next thing it's going to do is put out new flower buds. But they're not supposed to open until spring.
Okay. Well, buy your Northern Lights azalea a new calendar.
Right.
Here's an email from Hillary in Wausau, and Hillary wants to know, can I use row covers to start my tomatoes, and how would I harden them off?
Well, I'm not sure how you're planning on using your row covers. So tomatoes, row covers are fabulous. I use them a lot, both in our teaching garden as well as in my own home garden, because floating row cover, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, it's just a synthetic kind of a polyester fabric. It's very lightweight. It comes in different weights depending on what you're using it for. So it comes in really lightweight for insect exclusion. You can get heavier weights for frost protection. I use it a lot for frost protection in the fall. In the spring, I use it mostly for insect exclusion. And so you plant your vegetable garden, you can cover the whole garden with floating row cover, and you can keep it covered until the time that those fruits are going to require some pollination. So if you're growing something that's going to require visits from bees, bumblebees or honeybees or some other kind of pollinating insect, at that point you've got to take the cover off. So it's great for that. It can be used in early spring for frost protection as well. And it does not exclude light. It doesn't exclude moisture. So you can keep it on for a pretty long time. But once you start getting into fruit production, and this is more of a problem with the cucurbits, so squash, cucumber, melons, that sort of thing, once they start making female flowers, you have got to get that floating row cover off so that the bees can get to it and help you with your fruit production. So
I have a couple of more calls, including one from Steve in Waterford. Steve, welcome to Garden Talk.
Yeah, thank you very much. See, I had a question about if you, and I've done this with potatoes, when you buy potatoes and you see them start to sprout in your potato bin, you can plant them and they'll reproduce potatoes. But what about onions?
Well, you know, some onions you could definitely plant out, but depending on their day length requirement, what may happen is that when you plant them out in your garden, they may just flower. You can cut the flowers off and leave them in the garden for an extended period of time, and you might get a new bulb developing. Or you might not. It just depends on what the cultivar is and what your growth conditions are in your garden. Onion sets are not that expensive. You know, you could do this for fun just to see what happens. But if you really want to grow onions, you can start onions from seed really early in the spring, and then you end up more with the scallion. You know, it's mostly for non-bulbing green kind of onions, but they're very easy to grow. But the onion sets are very inexpensive, and you can buy hundreds of them and put them out in your garden in the spring, and at the end of the summer, you'll have a nice big bulbing onion to harvest.
Steve, thanks for that call. Bill in Ashland has a comment on using fish fertilizer. Bill, welcome to Garden Talk.
Yeah. When you guys mentioned that, using fish for fertilizer, I remember one time, you know, being inspired by the Pilgrim story of burying a fish. You know, the Indians showed them how to do that and raise corn. So I got a hold of some suckers that needed to be gotten rid of, and I buried them in my garden.
Boy, the
next day, oh my gosh, it looked like a miniature war zone out there. It was just all torn up to pieces, you know?
Yes, I'm sure that somebody had a party in your garden.
You had a garden party there, Bill. All right, we need to move on because we're running out of time here. We had a an email from Jane who wondered, should I cut off the yellow leaves on tomato plants?
Well, you know, once they have turned yellow, sometimes that yellowing is associated with a nitrogen deficiency. Sometimes it's associated with a disease infestation. So if you're getting little spots on your leaves, chances are you've got a fungal infection. When you're talking about just the lower leaves and removing those leaves, it's not a problem. But if your leaves are yellowing all the way up the plant, that's a problem that you need to address and figure out what is causing it. Because if you start to get fruit production and you don't have foliage on there to protect the developing fruit and to supply the developing fruit with, you know, the photosynthate it needs, you're not going to get very good fruit production. So as far as removing those lower leaves that are yellow, it's not a problem. But if it's spreading all the way up your plant, that's a problem.
All right. Well, we've got just a couple of minutes to go. A couple of quick questions here. First of all, we had a caller who wanted to know about the risks of using pressure-treated wood in a raised vegetable garden.
This is a really interesting issue, and we do have a publication on this. If you go into the Learning Store website, learningstore.uwx.edu, we do have a publication on raised bed gardening in the community garden series. And it depends on what it's treated with. Most of the pressure-treated wood that we get today is treated mostly with a copper-containing product. And it's not a huge problem. It doesn't really get into the soil that much. We often recommend that you line the bed, at least the wood-facing portion of the bed, with plastic before you fill it with your soil and compost mix to protect from it. But if it's older pressure-treated wood that has the arsenic in it or heaven forbid, railroad ties, absolutely not. We do not ever recommend using those for landscaping of any kind.
One more quick question, and we've only got about 25 seconds here. Is it okay to use a row cover on blueberries?
Blueberries, for a while, yes, but at some point you're going to need to uncover them. But they can be used to protect from insects if that's the problem. If you're trying to protect from birds, it might be a better idea to use the bird netting.
Okay. Well, Patty Nagai, thank you so much for spending this time on Garden Talk with me. It's been very, very informative.
Well, it's been really busy. We've had some really great questions, as always.
Oh, haven't
always.
We just?
Yeah. I'm kind of tired now. I might have to go take a nap.
Well, I have to actually get back to my day job. So, but first, maybe some lunch, maybe a nice beefsteak tomato sliced up on some toast.
That look for like those chocolate cherry tomatoes.
Chocolate cherry tomatoes. Yeah, I've got a note about that.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Cheyenne Lentz produced today's program and handled on-air production, and Dave Potratz also pitched in with his usual able assistance. And Patty Nagai was my guest, UW Extension horticulture educator for Racine County. Larry is back next week. I'm John Munson. in for Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.